aid alone will not solve the famine in Sudan. Famine in Sudan is not a happenstance result of the war. It is an intentional tool by both parties to use starvation as a weapon of war against communities in order to eke out some kind of political relevance.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Like any civil war, the conflict in Sudan has deep roots, but the proximate cause is a failed democratic transition. In 2019, the longtime dictator of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, was ousted from power in a coup. You may remember the scene. Thousands of peaceful protesters took to the streets of Khartoum to demand the end of nearly 30 years of Bashir's dictatorship. This was people power at its finest. Security forces tried to crack down on the protesters, but in the process only made them stronger. Eventually, Bashir's security forces saw the writing on the wall and ousted him in a coup. The coup leaders were two of the most powerful men in Sudan: the head of the Sudanese Armed Forces, the SAF, General Burhan, and General Hemedti, the head of the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF. Under heavy international and domestic pressure, these two military leaders shared power with a civilian government. For a short while, Sudan had a civilian prime minister titularly in charge of the government. Behind the scenes, Burhan and Hemedti jockeyed for power. Eventually, they joined forces and ousted the civilian prime minister. Shortly thereafter, they turned their guns on each other. On April 15, 2023, fighting spread from Khartoum to other parts of the country. This includes Darfur, where the conflict took on ugly ethnic dimensions, potentially to include a genocide. Today, Sudan is the largest humanitarian crisis by the numbers. Over 8 million people have been displaced, and the UN is warning of famine in parts of the country. My guest today, Khulud Khair, is the founder and director of Confluence Advisory, a think and do tank formerly based in Khartoum. She explains how the conflict has evolved over the last year and why the humanitarian crisis is as dire as ever. In our conversation, we spent a lot of time discussing potential ways out of this crisis, which thus far have been elusive. I cut my teeth covering the international response to the Darfur genocide nearly 20 years ago and have been following events in Sudan closely ever since. This crisis in Sudan is not a crisis that gets the attention it deserves, but I am proud of the fact that this podcast has been covering it consistently over the years, including when all the warning signs were there for a failed democratic transition over a year ago. To support this kind of consistent focus, not only on Sudan, but also on other undercovered global crises that don't get the attention they deserve, please support our show. You can go to globaldispatches.org and get a paid subscription. Or if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, you can support the show by getting a paid subscription directly in the podcast app with just a few taps of your thumb. We rely on a degree of listener support, and I thank you for helping us do what we do. Now, here is my conversation with Khalud Kher of Confluence Advisory. So we are speaking at the one-year anniversary of the Civil War, and I'm interested in learning from you how the conflict has evolved over the last year since fighting first erupted in Khartoum on April 15th, 2023.
Well, when the fighting started, it was very much, you know, two generals at the helm of two different institutions, effectively, if we can use that term, that were part of the same security structure, very much a security structure was created and evolved by the former dictator, General Omar al-Bashir. And the sort of dynamics between the two were very much charged by a personal enmity that had been developing for some time, actually since the coup that both generals had led together in 2021, and which really sort of started to break up the partnership that they had had for so long that eventually resulted in the war. And so, you know, the sort of enmity between the two of them, there were exchanges traded on international media platforms and international media channels, particularly Arabic language ones. It was all very heated and all very, you know, he betrayed me and he told me he would do X and never did. And that was initially what led a lot of people to think that this is something that could be walked back to some degree, because it was mostly an interpersonal issue, which is ridiculous to think about it. But as the war progressed, it has become clearer and clearer what kind of interests lay behind the two generals. And there's been a centrifugal force, really, around the two of them that has pulled different groups, different domestic constituencies, and different political beliefs around the two generals. So we now have this great polarization that started off pretty soon after the war broke out, but has only deepened. And we're seeing this polarization across all different parts of the country. So that's one main trend that we've seen. It's gone from two generals to a myriad collection of different armed actors, but also from this much more intimate rivalry between the two of them to a larger nationwide ruckus. And that is expressed in different parts of the country in different ways. And so, for example, where we have the national level conflict really being waged over national level power and resources, we also have within that the layers of the regional or the local level conflicts, which in many ways have expressed themselves as the atrocities in, for example, West Darfur, where one group saw that another group had become much more well positioned during the past times and they wanted to sort of settle scores during this conflict. So we're seeing this multi-layered element of it as well. And lastly, one thing we have definitely seen progress during last year, which is probably the most worrying beyond the polarization, beyond sort of taking in different elements of society, is the fragmentation that we're seeing. We're seeing a Sudanese armed forces with at least two positions right now. You have a camp that is more liable to engage in negotiation, and a camp within the Sudanese armed forces that absolutely will not engage in negotiation and has said that very publicly. And then on the other side, on the RSF, someone told me recently that the RSF is a franchise. And I think that's actually quite a helpful way of looking at it. You have people who wield guns begotten through the RSF and they wear the uniforms of the RSF, perhaps, but they very much follow their own political logics and their own political ambitions. And what fragmentation on the RSF side might give us is effectively an increase in warlords that cover territories and do not necessarily follow orders from above, which means now all of our thinking about what this war has looked like, that it's this conflict between two main institutions, may soon require us to look actually at sort of a deeper level, you know, where the fault lines on both of these camps, in particular the RSF camps, where fragmentation looks increasingly likely. The impact that has on the ground is that Sudan itself as a territory could also become quite fragmented. And so many speak of the Somalialization of Sudan, where you have warlords effectively having taken over different parts of the country and creating their own little fiefdoms, making trade, making aid, making cross-territory engagement very, very difficult. And of course, in a sort of a grander scale, the macro level, peace and overall peace of the country harder to bring about.
I mean, just as you're describing it, it seems that one key trend in this conflict is that the longer it has gone on, which is now a year, the more complex it has become, and therefore the more difficult it is to unravel.
Yes, exactly that. But also, of course, followingly, that the longer it goes on, the more difficult and complex it will become and more difficult it will be to resolve.
Which, of course, implies that the sooner we can resolve this, the better. Not only in humanitarian terms, just because it will be more simple to resolve now than it would be, say, another year from now, as these conflict dynamics evolve even further.
Yes, but really, for me, the humanitarian picture is the more important one. You know, the ground movements of the RSF, of SAF, we're seeing a very back and forth kind of war of attrition playing out. And that will probably continue for some time. I think it's far more useful for us to think about what the impact this is having on the citizens of Sudan, those of whom have not been able to seek any kind of refuge. You know, Sudan is the biggest displacement crisis in the world today. We have figures of 8 to 11 million people displaced. That's higher than anywhere else in the world. We're seeing hunger levels also higher than anywhere else in the world, including by scale, Gaza. And we're seeing statistics coming out like 95% of people in the country, according to WFP, are not able to afford one meal a day. We have 19 million children, that's the bulk of Sudanese children, out of school. We have 10 million children, so half of the children in Sudan, you know, within 5 kilometers of an active war zone. We have 80% of health facilities not in working commission. And, you know, we can continue talking about the statistics, but just to give you a sense of the scale of this, leave alone what this means to people living the reality on a daily basis. So for me, the humanitarian picture is really the more important one, more than what's happening on the battlefield, because in any case, it's very unlikely that one side or the other will be able to have a full battlefield victory. That is historically not how Sudan's wars of this nature have been settled. They've almost always been settled through a mediated settlement and a political agreement. But in the meantime, of course, you have 50 million people who are at the mercy of the humanitarian situation that is a direct result of this war. But one thing to note about this is that while Sudan is facing famine, and the UN has been very slow to declare this, but by all indicators, famine is taking place already, we are at the same time witnessing, you know, very little global attention, but also very little funding. So the humanitarian envelope of the UN is $2.6 billion, and it's only 5% funded as of right now. And that just shows you the dearth of attention.
I actually have a whole set of questions on that very question, the lack of attention to Sudan that's resulted in really high, what the UN calls unmet requirements in terms of humanitarian funding. You know, there is intended to be, the day this is released, on the 15th, a meeting in France on the humanitarian situation in Sudan. What are your expectations from that meeting? And what do you hope to come from that meeting? Because as you described, this is a woefully underfunded humanitarian crisis, even as the humanitarian situation on the ground is getting much, much worse very quickly for all the reasons you describe.
I think the humanitarian conference in Paris comes at a critical point where we are standing on the precipice of wide-scale famine. We're already seeing famine-like conditions across the country. But I think because the UN has not declared a famine across the country, the requisite funding that would usually follow that has not followed. And so Paris gives us an opportunity to try and write that. And there are already some commitments that are coming across from different actors that have been committed ahead of Paris that will be announced during the Paris conference. Now, it's one thing for the US, which is the largest humanitarian donor, and the EU and its member states, which together bring up actually more than even the US contribution. But really, we have to think about countries closer to Sudan, particularly in the Gulf, that have a lot of money, have already made commitments to Sudan as of June last year, the Geneva Humanitarian Pledging Conference, and have not put that money through. So we have, for example, a deficit of 50% from the Saudis, but only 28% that the Qataris pledged last year has been given, and a pitiful 5% from the United Arab Emirates of what was committed last year has been given. So those numbers we need to see rise from the region, because those countries actually have a lot more political and economic investment in Sudan than many countries in the West. And because of the proximity of Sudan to them and to the Red Sea and key areas of interest and foreign policy attention for these countries, we need to effectively see them putting a lot more investment in this. So my hope is, because we will see representation from some of these countries at the pledging conferences, we'll also see the levels of funding from these countries increase. All that is to say, money is one thing. The other part of this equation is, once you have the money and once you're able to buy the aid, bringing it to the areas of the country where it's needed is going to be really important. And right now there's a big discussion happening between the belligerents and the United Nations and the international aid industry about how to gain access to key areas. And we have seen significant aid blocking mechanisms and ways of diverting aid, really, from both sides to various degrees. But again, even if you have the money and even if you have the requisite access, aid alone will not solve the famine in Sudan. Famine in Sudan is not a happenstance result of the war. It is an intentional tool by both parties to use starvation as a weapon of war against communities in order to eke out some kind of political relevance. And so we have to understand that first and foremost. We have to work in ways that do not put the control of aid delivery in the hands of the belligerents, do not allow them to use aid in a partisan manner, and for example, prioritize the localization agenda and make sure we work with local groups, particularly emergency response rooms and other mutual aid volunteer-based groups, to make sure that they're able to actually put the aid where it needs to go.
So the humanitarian crisis is obviously a consequence of just failed peace processes. And, you know, it seems to me there is just this proliferation of peace processes underway in Sudan or regarding Sudan right now. You have the Jeddah process led by Saudi Arabia. You have negotiations and discussions in Cairo between the UAE and Egypt. You have the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, which is a regional body that is leading some efforts, and efforts by the African Union. You know, I've seen it said, and I wonder if you agree with this assessment, that the proliferation of various peace processes is actually an obstacle to a peace process right now, that there is no coherence between them. Is that your assessment?
I think there's certainly something to be said for the term too many cooks. And part of the reason is not necessarily how many tracks there are, but the fact that they don't work together. So, for example, it makes sense for the Egyptians to be leading on humanitarian access talks, for example, or availing humanitarian pathways, because it borders Sudan and has a massive border with Sudan and has corralled a few neighboring countries in a neighboring countries initiative that could be redesigned effectively to facilitate humanitarian access. And equally, that, for example, the Jeddah talks coupled with some other talks like the Manama talks held in Bahrain earlier this year would then pick up the mantle on the ceasefire track. But these processes are subject to international and regional rivalries. And Sudan, in many ways, is finding itself in the middle of that geopolitical tug of war within the region. And if you consider where Sudan sits, it's on the Red Sea, it's in the Horn of Africa, it's in the Sahel. It's in a very geostrategically important place for many actors, not just in the region, but further afield. So we're not seeing the traction within these different mediation tracks as we would hoped. But there's also an element of this link to the methodology behind some of these mediations. You know, mediation is not a science. It is very much more of an art, but there are very sort of concrete steps, logical steps that would make sense. So for example, step one needs to be that you have consensus from the region that the war should stop. It's not altogether clear that we have that. And certainly, if not with many countries in the region, either picking a side or hedging between the two sides.
For example, perhaps like the United Arab Emirates is, you know, content to keep supporting the RSF to press their gains.
Yes, although the United Arab Emirates also has linkages and engagements with the Sudanese armed forces, but certainly it is engaging far more and far more consistently with the RSF. And there have been very well documented instances where the United Arab Emirates has been sending a full sort of gravy train of weaponry to the RSF and has been consistently been doing that since the war started. But you also have other countries in the region that are giving support to, for example, the Sudanese armed forces. The Sudanese armed forces is going to, for example, Turkey, to Qatar, to Iran more recently and more sort of profoundly to access drones. It's even gone as far afield as China in order to get those drones. The UAE also has been, you know, relying on Wagner in the region, particularly at the beginning of the war, though now we understand that mostly it relies on the United Arab Emirates for weaponry. So the region is implicated, and that's why you need regional consensus that the war must end. And once you have that regional consensus, you can then put forward the incentive structures that are needed to incentivize both sides to adhere to a ceasefire, and more importantly, disincentivize them from breaking the terms of that ceasefire. And once you have those two steps, then you can move forward and formalize them in a mediation where you then also engage civilians, women's groups, everyone who's usually left out of these kinds of conversations, and really try and hammer down the details. Now, we haven't done any of that. Most of the mediation platforms that you have mentioned have gone straight into step three, trying to hammer out the details of what a ceasefire looks like. And without having done step one and two, consensus and then the leverage or the incentives, you're not really going to be able to get anything adhered to by either party.
On this question, this most basic question of a regional consensus that is required to understand and acknowledge that this war should stop, is there any international actor that has like the juice to bring those regional actors together and, you know, make it so and convince them that this war ought to stop?
So ideally, it would be an entity like the UN that is the parent organization of all of these states. All of these states are member states of the United Nations. And therefore, the UN could potentially, you know, sort of corral them into some kind of consensus on Sudan. But that isn't happening. The UN has had very little attention on Sudan. It has put in place an envoy, but he's a personal envoy of the Secretary General. He doesn't necessarily have the full backing of the UN Security Council in the way that a special representative would. Beyond that, you know, the UN doesn't really have leverage over any of these countries. The UN has no leverage over the UAE, over Saudi Arabia, over Egypt, over Iran, in a way that is commensurate to them coming on the table in a sincere fashion to try and end this war. So when we think about, you know, who else it could be, obviously the US is a major contender, but the US too has had very little policy attention at the highest levels on what's going on in Sudan. So we've had very little, if any, engagement from the White House, none at all, from the president, nor from the National Security Council, etc. And at the State Department, there has been sort of MISO level, if we can call it that, attention from, for example, the Bureau of African Affairs, but not very much from the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. And because of that, that's not sending the message to US allies in the region, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, the United Arab Emirates, that the US is serious about this conflict ending. There has recently been an envoy appointed, and he's only been in the job for about a month and a half. But we still don't see, for example, President Biden speaking about Sudan. We don't see Secretary Blinken speaking about Sudan or National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan speaking about Sudan. It's not at the level of, for example, other conflicts, Ukraine and otherwise, where there is a clear indication that the US is serious. So what that means is US allies in the region are effectively eking out their own little zones of influence and using some of the conflict dynamics within Sudan to try and further their own foreign policy agendas, not very much in line with any kind of agenda that looks towards democracy or looks towards civilian government, which is what the people of Sudan have struggled for 5 years. So there is a disconnect there with what the US wants and what its allies in the region want. And so we don't have that consensus in the way that we do. We also have to contend with the fact that US allies in the region do not want to see a successful democracy in Sudan. And the US has not found a way to sort of mitigate that, not just in Sudan, but in the region as a whole.
And again, on this US engagement, you referred to the new US envoy, that's Tom Perriello. He's actually been a guest on this podcast in the past, but he's like, I think probably the third envoy since Biden took office to Sudan. And as you said, it just really hasn't reached high levels of attention in the White House in a way at least commensurate to the scale of the crisis, though probably Congress has paid a bit more attention to it for a variety of reasons. So, I mean, essentially, are you saying that it's neglect from the White House that is exacerbating this conflict, or at least not helping its allies in the region lead them to the conclusion that this war ought to be stopped?
Yeah, I mean, Tom Perriello is the fourth envoy in the past few years. And his appointment is very welcome. You know, he's a former congressman, so is able to understand Congress and the way that works and how that can be leveraged within the system. He's ensconced within the State Department, which hasn't always, it must be said, had the right approach on Sudan. Certainly since the coup of 2021, we have seen policy after approach from the State Department that has not been very helpful. But we've heard crickets, effectively, from the White House. The White House has been completely disengaged on this issue. And because of that, you have this sort of disconnect even within the different branches of the US government. So first things first, I mean, for Mr. Perriello, it's going to be quite difficult to corral the US government on a unified approach on Sudan and a sort of similar, if not the same, level of prioritization. You know, Congress has been consistently good on keeping Sudan at the forefront of its affairs, pushing a state and to some degree the White House on, giving answers on, for example, the lackluster approach they have had to Sudan, not even since the war, but before that, since the coup. So that's going to be quite difficult to achieve, particularly in an election year. But I think as we, you know, charted earlier, you know, Sudan really is standing on a precipice right now of famine, of fragmentation, and sort of a fallout, effectively, to the rest of the region, which can be hugely destabilizing. So I guess the question is, if not now, then when? I think the Biden administration does need to significantly up its focus on Sudan. Right now, it very much appears that if it treats Sudan as a tier three issue, but it needs to, I think, figure out very quickly what the perils of that approach will be.
Khulood, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.